Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt. I'm playing Cyberpunk now, Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
It's an interesting game. I don't think we have time to really talk about it, but I've barely got stuck in. I've made like 8 characters and deleted like 7 of them, but... You know, I'm one of those people with character creators and games, and it's happening to me in WoW now too. Not that this is lore, so I can't talk about that much either. But yeah, that whole thing where you have enough options to get you in trouble, that happens to me in character creators.
Yeah, one of those things where we're spoiled for choice, and that choice, well, it is kind of spoiling. But we're not going to be talking about that today. We'll probably bring that back up on Tuesday for our other podcast, for the Blizzard Watch podcast. So if you don't listen to that, maybe give this one a try. But we're going to be answering questions from lovely folks, our Patreon supporters, and folks and listeners that maybe not necessarily are Patreon supporters. You sent us a bunch of questions. I'm going to go ahead and read them out, and we're going to answer them. If you do have questions for the podcast, be sure to send them in to podcast@blizzardwatch.com, singular podcast. And if you don't want to do email and you are a Patreon supporter, you want to get your messages highlighted, you can go to our Discord channel, where we have a specific channel set aside for Patreon Q and supporter questions. Actually, pretty much everything we're going to be going through today came from that, so thank you very much. If you don't have the ability to support us on Patreon and you don't want to do an email, we do have one for non-Patreon supporters. It's just podcasting Q questions. You can throw it in there. That is one of the other places we do look. But be sure to send them in, and we'll be happy to answer them as they fit. Make sure you do specify what show it is for, and if you have a special pronunciation for your character or name that you wish to be read off as, please include it. It makes my life a lot easier. Our first one is going to be from Ferentis. What's the difference between a rogue and a demon hunter in Diablo? And this is going to be where I let Matt talk a little bit about that because, well, it's Diablo stuff.
Well, I had just written a relatively long post. Well, I didn't just write it. I wrote it a year ago, but it got reposted recently. I can actually talk about this to some detail. Basically, rogues are not at all related to demon hunters. They are completely different. They come from a different source. Rogues come from the tradition created by the Amazons. And the Amazons were basically started by a Nephilim who was in love with an angel. I don't remember the names off the top of my head. Sorry, guys, but The Nephilim and the angel were in love, but the angel left when the non-interference pact was created between heaven and hell and ceased all contact with the Nephilim in question, leaving that Nephilim somewhat adrift as the love of their life had abandoned them as far as they could tell. After a lifetime of wandering, since as a Nephilim, they were practically immortal. They lived much longer than a normal human. They eventually stumbled upon the Scova's Isles. And I think at the time they weren't called the Scovos Isles. In fact, I think Nephilim's name might have been Scovos, to be completely honest with you, but I don't remember, unfortunately. But that Nephilim found that island, and there was a perfectly normal human living on that island, and they then fell in love and had a relationship from which was born several children, and those children were the forebears of the Amazons. And the one thing that they had from their forebear, was a device called the Sightless Eye. And the Sightless Eye was an artifact that could be used to contact the angel that the Nephilim had originally been in love with. It could also do many other things. It could see into the past and future and all sorts of stuff. The Sightless Eye became kind of like a centerpiece to their culture. There were people in Amazon culture who felt that they were misusing the device. They weren't making proper use of it. They weren't using it to its fullest potential. They stole the device and fled to the mainland, specifically to the area around Tristram. You've heard of them as the Sisterhood of the Sightless Eye. That's where the rogues come from. The rogues are essentially the sisters of the Sisterhood of the Sightless Eye. That's where their original tradition comes from in Diablo lore. Now, we don't know. There's going to be other criminal organizations in Diablo 4, so they might not have any connection to the Sightless Eye or the Amazons. But the rogues we saw in the original Diablo, the rogue we saw in that, and the rogue, the monastery of the Sightless Eye that we saw in Diablo 2, they come from the same tradition. They come from the rogue tradition that was started by expatriate Amazons that ran away from the Scovos Isles and attempted to use the artifact to contact the High Heavens. And that's the difference between them and the Amazons. And the Demon Hunters have nothing to do with any of it. They're just people who were in one way or another, harmed by demons, whether it was personally, whether it was loved ones getting killed, whatever, who were found by somebody who initiated them into the new Demon Hunter tradition, which is not in any way related to the rogues.
It almost, like, the Demon Hunters in Diablo 3 almost feel like a kinship with the story origin of the Demon Hunters in WoW, where it's like...
Yeah, literally, something horrible happened to you because of demons, and you learn to fight demons with, like, the secrets that you plumbed from, the arcane and so forth. You notice that the discipline and hatred power source of the Demon Hunters in Diablo 3 is a unique. It's their own special thing. So, yeah, they're not rogues. They're not related to them. The fact that they do a lot of range stuff just happens to be what they do. It's not, everybody who uses a bow has to be related to everybody else who uses a bow. No, that's not how this works. It just happens to be that both rogues and demon hunters use ranged weapons.
Yeah, so I can understand why people would think that there's some form of similarities for it, especially because from a game design perspective, they tend to fill somewhat of a similar role with each other, just with different mechanics. But from a story perspective, wildly different. Our next question comes from Ekjek. Question for the lore bros. Your recent Anduin and Chains of Domination discussion has me thinking. Jaina mentioned while captive that they were being tested on. Do you think the distinction between wielding channeling one of the cosmic forces could have been what the jailer was looking for? Jaina may be one of Azeroth's strongest wielders of the arcane, but she doesn't channel it. The jailer needed someone who could channel his power to be his pawn. We did talk about, I think, this pretty extensively last lore watch, which is what Ekjek is referring to. And if you haven't listened to that yet, I highly recommend you do, especially if you don't mind spoilers and want to talk a little bit more about that Chains of Domination cinematic. It is an interesting thought. Like, we talked about Anduin becoming the perfect vessel because he doesn't have a sense of self, but part of that was also that he's used to channeling or becoming a conduit for the light, at least from my perspective. Do you think that the way that Jaina wields her power is what made her unsuitable as a vessel? It's kind of similar to how Thrall wouldn't have been a good vessel because he doesn't actually channel things through him necessarily. He simply, if from the shamanic tradition, asks the elements to do the thing for him versus Anduin, who, as a light wielder in his particular specialty, actually invites it into himself and through himself. Do you think that that's what makes the distinction?
I mean, who knows? It could be. It's kind of like you're asking me to speculate on something that we're already speculating on. So I'm speculating on the speculation at this point. Maybe, could be. I mean, there certainly seems to be, like we've talked about before, I think there's a reason that he picked the people he picked, and I think that the fact that he tried to get Tyrande is important. And we keep kind of ignoring it because the other ones are the ones who actually got caught.
But Tyrande was also targeted. Yeah, we can't forget that.
I mean, and to a certain degree, I mean, we don't know who chose the targets. Like, we don't know if the jailer gave Sylvanas a list or if Sylvanas decided, well, they've been messing with me anyway, so. You know, we don't know why they were chosen or who they were chosen by yet.
So,
but it seems likely, if you look at the people that were picked, the only one who really stands out to me is Bane. Far as I can tell, Bane does not channel or summon or control any cosmic forces. Bane is just a really strong-willed person. It might have been out of, you know, if Sylvanas picked them, it might have been out of sheer, like, you know, not wanting contempt. Bane on the playing field. No, not contempt. She doesn't hold him in contempt. If you read War Crimes, there's a moment where Sylvanas does hold him in contempt, and then he comes over and very quietly, like, you know, he puts his hand around her wrist and says, stop now. And she realizes,
he can crush her.
Yeah, I have been thinking you were weak, and you could break me in half without even, like, you know, Bane is extremely strong, but he isn't channeling, like, you know, the elements or the arcane or the power of a god or the light or any of that. So it is interesting that you notice Bane was the one who was experimented on.
But also, I have another idea that occurred to me, especially since our last discussion, in particular because Tyrande was included into it. Every single person in that list has had a crisis of self, right? So, like, Jaina just went through that last expansion. She had a crisis of self. Bane had a sort of crisis of, how do I lead my people? Plus, you know, what is my role in the Horde and all this other stuff that just happened to him relatively recently as well. Then you have Thrall, who just had a crisis of self because he couldn't call on the elements anymore. And a key piece of himself, that had been some part of his identity for quite a number of years and central to who he was gone. And then you have Tyrande, who reaches out to Alun, who invites the Night Warrior into herself. Maybe it's not about power. Maybe it's about what you were talking about last week, where it's the crisis itself allows for the opportunity for that to press into their personality, what normally couldn't. But the downside is, with all of those people that have been picked, it almost seems like they were the wrong timing. They had already figured out who they were. They had come through the other side of the crisis, all of them except Anduin, who is still figuring out who he is. You brought this point up last week, and it sticks with me. He is the only one on that list that doesn't fully, truly understand who he is yet, because he hasn't had that opportunity. And then look at some of the other vessels that were potential choices way back when, like, and why they didn't work, right? We talked about Ner'zhul. He didn't have a body, but even if he did have a body, he was pretty sure of himself. Pretty sure he knew who he was, right?
At that point, yeah, he'd been misled by the Horde. He'd lost his wife. He'd been an Elder Shaman for years. I do think that, like, if you're talking about that, and I don't know that that's actually accurate or not, but if you're talking about that, Tyrande's a singularly horrible choice.
Oh, I would agree.
Yeah, Tyrande never really, even when she was, like, going along with everything that Alun said or wanted, she was still very sure of herself.
But the question is, if Sylvanas was the one that was choosing the targets, did she know that?
Because, I don't know what Sylvanas knows about Tyrande.
Yeah.
To be totally honest.
Because, like, but, you know, she's a terrible warrior at this point, but I'm starting to wonder if she doesn't realize that she is the Night Warrior, that she has sort of that conviction now. She just burned her home down. She did something so horrible that should cause an identity crisis, right? Like, if you're trying to break somebody down and rip their heart out and shatter them, that seems like what almost like that move was designed to do.
Yeah, I think the problem there is quite possibly that Sylvanas doesn't understand that she is like a child compared to Tyrande.
I would agree.
Sylvanas, for all that she is an elf and has lived hundreds of years, Tyrande has lived tens of thousands of years. And Tyrande has seen the Legion burn her entire world. She's seen her people, like, get taken back to, like, practically no civilization at all and had to rebuild. She led them through that. She was doing it by herself because her, you know, Shando, her, you know, beloved, well, you know, Shando means teacher, it doesn't mean beloved one, but, you know, her beloved one was sleeping for most of the time, so she had to do it practically on her own with nobody but her kid to help her. Then the Legion returned, and she, you know, if you, we see every time we see Tyrande act, we see that Tyrande does not hesitate and does not second guess herself.
Mm-hmm.
Like she straight up, you know, she's like, I'm going to free Illidan. No, we can't free Illidan. I'm going to free Illidan. If you don't move, I will move you, but I'm going to free Illidan. And, you know, it's like, even Malfurion's like, you can't do it. And she's like, you don't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Like you don't, nobody tells me what to do unless their name is Alun. And when things came hard, when Sylvanas quote unquote broke Tyrande, she broke her in such a way that she went up to her god and said, no, you will not allow this. You will give me the power to fight this, or I will not be, you know, I will not be the high priest of a goddess who does not, you know, stand up for her people. So you give me the power. And she did.
Yeah. And I mean, you know? it almost seems like it was a plan that backfired, but I just can't help get it out of my head that it seems like the identity crisis of part of the key.
I don't know, though, because Bane didn't really have it. If Bane ever had an identity crisis, it was back before his father died. Maybe you could argue that he had a slight identity crisis after his father died, but I don't really feel like he did. I feel like he had a crisis of, what am I doing here? Why am I in the Horde if the Horde is going to be this? He had that under Garrosh, and he had that under Sylvanas, but it was never a crisis of conscience or a crisis of the self. He never doubted himself. But then again, we keep making the assumption that, how do I put this? You might not want to pick all people with the same psychological problem. You might want different people for different reasons, mm-hmm. because you need to see what will work. The whole point was they had no idea what was work. Thrall even says it's like they were testing us, but he wouldn't say what he wanted. He didn't know what he wanted. He didn't know what he was looking for until he sees it. That whole bit with Anduin, like throwing up the light barrier and stopping him, that's what he was looking for, but he didn't know that's what he was looking for until he got it. That's the thing about blind testing these strange people from another world. You're looking for something, but you don't know what it is. So it's quite possible that they went into this with no idea of what they were doing. And thus Sylvanas was just told by the jailer, bring me these people. I don't, you know, bring me people. Mm-hmm, I need mm-hmm. people to look at. Bring me the strongest people you can find. And she just grabbed the people that were the most, you know, and thus her selection of Tyrande was just, well, she's really powerful. So sure. Not realizing how powerful she was, that she commanded enough force to at least bulk the jailer's forces. And that's an interesting thing too. Of all of them, only Tyrande was able to prevent her own abduction.
Yeah, which I find fascinating too, because one would have imagined that, like, Anduin, you can argue, yeah, he was taken off guard while he was mourning or whatever the case was, sure, but Gen was there too. Bane, we don't know the circumstances really around his, like, if anything else was really around him, but, like, Tyrande has that power inside of her that she could probably stand on her own pretty dang well, yeah, but so could Jaina.
Yeah, but here's the implication, though. Jaina and Thrall are calling upon... Thrall barely even has the elements, as far as I know. Like, I don't even know if they respond to him.
He does. Canonically, as story-wise, he gets them back in the Torghast freeing event.
Okay. But in terms of Jaina's concern, Jaina's an extremely powerful mage, and we see that in the fact that she frees herself several times. But she's stuck in the maw, so that didn't do her much good. But the difference between Jaina and Tyrande is... And I think this is really, really important. We have no idea what Illun is.
Yeah.
The light doesn't have a driving force. It doesn't have a personification. So I can understand why the jailer is able to ultimately overwhelm Anduin. But Tyrande, we have no idea what Illun is. If Illun is a first one, then if anything, she might be more powerful than the jailer. And in a straight up confrontation, he'd lose.
Which could also be why the vessels of Illun's wrath burn out as they do.
Because you're channeling the kind of cosmic power. What's the old thing? Ultimate cosmic power, itty bitty living space.
Yeah. But there's no limiter on it now. Right. Yeah. Like there's no wristbands to keep you from that ultimate power. There's rules. But with the Night Warrior, there really isn't.
The interesting thing about since we don't know, we're dealing with a lot of not knowing, but to get back to all of this, it's quite possible. We're speculating about speculation at this point. It's quite possible that it is the one way or another, but we don't really know, and we won't know for quite some time. I do think it's interesting that he is literally driving Anduin around I still think it's like a drone. He's got Anduin like a drone doing stuff, and he can Anduin can occasionally exert himself, but then the jailer can just bear down on him.
Yeah.
It's literally the old classic concept of obsession, which is control from outside versus possession.
Possession, which is control from within.
Yeah, and obsession and possession, I mean, these are not, that's not what we use the modern term obsession for, but it's the original, which is literally control from outside. A spirit is not inside you, controlling you. It is outside directing you. Either way, I think a lot of this will come in time.
And
I don't think we've got the full picture yet. I do want to see more of like what's going on. Korthia is the name of the new realm we're going to?
Yes, Korthia.
I wonder what's going on with Korthia, because we know that at least some of the things I've seen indicate the Dreadlords might be there, that there's stuff there that looks like Ouroboros.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we speculated before about how the Maw feels broken. And I think that that's going to be something we're going to figure out, is that these other realms of the Shadowlands are all broken off. Originally, there was a Shadowlands equivalent of the Sundering. There was some event in the Shadowlands past that made it from one realm into these sub-realms. And I think that moment is going to be part and parcel of what we're investigating now. And it's going to reveal more about what's going on with Anduin.
I would agree. And I also think that there's going to be some heavy connotation when we start getting into this and start looking more at the Eye of the Jailer as well. And I think that's going to illuminate some of the stuff, like the choices that were made, because I do think that it wasn't Sylvanas's choice on who got picked. I think it was, this is, and again, pure speculation, I think him looking into our realm and just kind of watching at what's been going on, I think he was able to make some choices and say, go get me these people. But we'll find out more in the future, and I'm actually really excited about that, because I'm feeling like we're getting little tidbits, not just of what's going on with the Jailer and Anduin and how that all works in the selection process, but like you pointed out, like how the Shadowlands came to be, what their, pieces of it beforehand, and learning about some ancient far-off history that, being a Denizen of Azeroth, we had no idea existed, which I think is really, really interesting. Our next question. Greetings, lore experts. Lorperts? Trademark pending. The new cinematic for WoW was awesome. While I still have my issues about souls going to the Maw, cough, stop sending in their cough, I did see something that I'm sure was obvious to you all. Yes, the last horse just crossed the finish line. There's an overwhelming theme of choice. It ranges from Sylvanas Anduin's story to the very nature of the events of the Covenants in Ardenweald. A mask can take you over, or take over your body and take away your choice / self. In Bastion, you must give up yourself. No choice there. In Revendreth, you are forced to confront your past sins. In Maldraxxus, you need a bath? This one I don't know. Am I just reaching on this one? Keep up the awesome work, Mark. It is definitely a theme in the Shadowlands. What that theme will lead to, I don't know. But each of the Covenants does seem like it is a choice. In Maldraxxus, you can choose to fight, or you can choose to not fight, and then you just become bones in the ground. Bones in the giant abomination that is Maldraxxus, because I'm 100% on the train that Maldraxxus is a living thing. Or not living thing, whatever. It's an entity. Ardenweald, it's the same thing. Like, even with the process of resurrection, it's a choice. Folks can choose to stay and serve the Winter Queen or be reborn in whatever fashion, which I think is fascinating. In Bastion, we've seen that there was a choice. It was just not presented as such. They weren't given the option, but you have the Forsworn. You have the folks that aren't serving the Maw quite yet, but are choosing not to let go of their memories and their sense of self. And then you have Revendreth, where there is actually a choice. You are forced to confront your past sins, but your choice is to let go and become more than it, or to hold on to that and constantly bear the burden of what you did, right? So there is definitely an overwhelming theme of choice throughout the Shadowlands in general, and I don't know where it's going yet. What about you, Matt?
I mean, I keep going back to Illidan refusing the light, and he says, "My scars." And then, if you've done the fight with Kael'thas in Castle Nathria, Kael'thas won't let go, and it's clearly a source of strength to him. It's a source of power to him. He won't release who he was. He won't let go, and as a result, I mean, he practically, he's flinging fire around like it's nobody's business. The guy has not lost a step. He is.
If anything, I think he might be more powerful now.
Yeah, and granted he's dead, but nevertheless, he's dead, but he has not released who he is. He refuses to do so. Maldraxxus, I feel like it's the old fight or die trope, mm-hmm. but it's also the concept of, like, they abandon, like, you see them changing physically. They abandon their form in a lot of cases. They choose to become the distillation of who they of that conflict within themselves. They choose to become conflict in a way. And it's interesting, Mograine didn't. They even have a thing about Mograine talking to Vash about it. About why did Vash, you know, Vash didn't have to be Inaga. In fact, the implication is when she arrived as a night elf.
Mm-hmm.
Like when she got to Maldraxxus, she was a night elf. Or that you can pick whatever form you want. Like there's certain implications there. We know that Amber Kiernan became like a spider person, which might be the perfect distillation of what her role was in life. the kind of, you know, skulking in the shadows, spinning webs, sort of trapping people thing that Amber did as a rogue in life, she embodies in death. So it feels like there's a choice to distill yourself down. You can choose to take up arms. You can choose to become more like a honed blade. You can make that choice. People also remember, if things were working properly, you don't have to stay in a realm.
Yeah, you can move between them.
Yeah,
As a matter of fact, you can actually find, if you choose Revendreth, it's kind of like the big joke among people in my guild, but like you throw tea parties, and it's not just people in Revendreth that come to them. You go and invite folks from the other covenants. Like, there is clear movement between them when the gates are open.
When things are working properly. And obviously things are right now not working properly, but there is that idea that there's like a certain amount of movement through. Like you can, if you succeed in Revendreth and you have your Simpurge, you don't have to stay in Revendreth. Like you don't have to stay and become a Venthyr. You can, you're given the option, but you can leave. People do. So again, if things were working properly, but I definitely think there's a certain amount of trying to find the place that suits you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like sort of like a giant cosmic sorting hat. And I'm going to say up front, I've never read a single one of those books, so I have no idea if that's a good metaphor. But yeah, it's basically just finding that place that suits you. Find the place that you suit and the place that suits you is a big part of it. The whole idea of the choices. The choices aren't always good, but they're choices. As for Ardenweald, I think there's choice in Ardenweald. I think that the real crime of the Drust is, in fact, that they steal choices from you. And to a certain degree, so do the others. The Mossworn, or the Forsworn, are stealing choices because they're lying.
Mm-hmm.
And if you lie to people, if you don't reveal, oh, but we're working with the Jailer and the Maw this whole time, which they don't. Only like, you know, only two people knew that in the Forsworn. And the Mossworn obviously know, but the Mossworn are not the Forsworn. The Forsworn are specifically Kyrian who have said, no, this place is not working. But they were being given faulty information. They were being told, you know, okay, we're going to retain who we were, and we're going to, but they're not being told, and by the way, the Jailer is backing us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see how Uther was like, oh my God, no, when he found out. So yeah, there is an element of choice and the abrogation of that choice in different ways. In Maldraxxus, it's the choices. Basically, I would say Maldraxxus is the one where people are making the choice to betray their purpose, but they're still making a choice. It's the only one where the choice is still there in the villains of it, I think. Whereas, but then again, they're also working with the Jailer, so ultimately it's going to end up being no choice. That's the thing, that the Jailer is ultimately all about. Everything gets distilled down to what he wants, which is escape. So yeah, I think there's a point to that, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. Our next question comes from our good friend 6K. Question for Lore Watch. What's the significance of the single blood-red mascara stripe underneath Sylvanas' right eye in the new cinematic? Was it always there?
It's an axe wound to her face.
It is absolutely an axe wound to her face. Although, it's from the Mat Gora that she fought with Sarfang. Just before she was ousted from the Horde, when she basically said that the Horde was nothing. But it is interesting that it's red, and I don't know if that is significant, because she is not a living creature. She doesn't bleed, not like everybody else. And if anything, I think you've mentioned this before, it's almost like she's a banshee inhabiting her own body, where like we've seen her sort of like discaporeate or whatever, like she's just left her body at during the battle for Lordaeron. You actually see her like explode out of her body. I don't know if that is significant or not, but I'm kind of curious if it is, because again, she doesn't bleed. She's not a living thing. Why is it red? Or is it just an artistic choice because they want to show the scar and don't have another way to do it? So,
well, I'm actually like looking at her face right now in the more recent cinematics, and to be honest with you, it's not really particularly red. I mean, it just looks like an extremely, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know that it's that pronounced. It's very hard to see much difference between it and all the other stuff coming down her face. So that's just me looking at it now. So I don't know. That's a good question in terms of why would it be red. I think to a certain degree it would be red because like it would be a little face. I mean, it's a wound to the face. You got me. I don't actually see it as particularly red in the most recent cinematic. I was just looking at.
Yeah, you can kind of see it. It's almost because the color is a little bit muted just because of it. But like when she looks at Anduin's, I don't want to say choiceless. I'll say choiceless body, because he's not dead. When she's looking at the drone that is Anduin now, when she looks over, there is definitely a red hue to it. But everything else on her is washed out because that's just kind of the way that her color scheme is right now. It's kind of like the way of Shadowlands in general. Everything seems like just a little bit washed out. But I don't know if there is a significance there. It's something that I think we'll learn a little bit more about later on. And I think it'll be something that we'll have when we start getting an answer to the question of what is Sylvanas. Then I think we'll start getting a little bit closer to the answer of why that wound is red and if it does have any significance. But for right now, it's just because that's where she got hit in the face with an axe. All right. Our next question comes from Godzilla, our favorite gigantic lizard. Question for Lorewatch. So I'm 95% sure Sylvanas isn't dying in 9.1, just like Jaina and Azjara, her fellow warbringers from BFA. But I do think Sylvanas is going to go rogue. She won't be allying with us, but she's going to oppose the jailer and still go about what she had initially thought the plan was. As much as I have been pretty meh on Tyrann's revenge story, I do think she is in a very particular spot. I think that we're going to see the Night Warrior power consume her, if only briefly, and Zaval gets his chains on her. Second, which of these reunions are you most looking forward to? Thrall and Draka, Thrall and Garrosh, Kael'thas and Jaina, Uther and Jaina / Kalia, or everyone in Arthas? Arthas's legacy preeminates everything, or permeates everything in the expansion, it feels like, so I think it's only a matter of time till he shows up. Perhaps the jailer's personal torture cell, part of the raid. It would make sense, as he is a failed Lich King in Zoval's eyes. That's a good set of questions. I don't think Sylvanas is going to die in 9.1. When they announced her as a raid boss, I didn't think she was going to die, and I don't think we're going to even capture her. I think she is going to make an escape. So,
yeah, if anything, it'll probably be one of those fights where you fight her till she like is, you know, damaged enough to leave. Similar to Jaina at the end of Siege of Dazar'alor, Battle for Dazar'alor. I think it'll be similar to that in terms of what happens to Sylvanas.
Yeah,
I don't know if she's going to turn against the jailer right away. I think it'll be much more along the lines of she might be there, but now aware that he basically left her to get stomped while he was running around doing his stuff. She does not have any intrinsic value to him. She's there as long as she serves a purpose to him. You know, that's fine. But once she's done what he wants her to do, she no longer has any intrinsic value to him, and she's going to start looking to her own.
And I'm actually wondering if we're already at that point too, especially with the Anduin stuff going on, because she gave him what he wanted, and it seemed like that was what her primary task was find a vessel. And so I'm kind of curious if we're going to get to that point sooner rather than later, where it's like, hey, he's not asking me to do anything anymore. I've basically been left behind. And I think that might be part of the significance of her as a raid boss when we find her, because like you pointed out, I think last week as well, it might have on the, I think it was the BlizzCon or 2 weeks ago on the BlizzCon recap, that if she's there, there's a reason, because he's not, the jailer is not there. And it's, did she get left behind? And if she got left behind, why? Why is she there? And it can't just be just to deal with us. There has to be something else going on, because that sort of makes sense. And if she's at that point where she's been abandoned again and she's been left again, then maybe she does start looking to her own. The other variable is we still don't know if or what happened to Nathanos, and if that's going to be playing into it at all either. Because
I expect we'll probably see him in her fight.
I would hope so.
I would not hope so. I would be perfectly happy to never see Nathanos again.
I kind of like his little arrogant self.
I hate him. Don't want any more of him.
But I would not be surprised if there was an aspect to what's going on or what she's doing that was a bit of a longer con or a longer game. Maybe.
Actually, no. I gotta keep going on this.
Okay.
You can't move past it. My problem with this, and my problem with Lathanos, is that they had a moment where they actually did something interesting with him at the end of Battle for Azeroth, where, you know, the whole my love bit, and then they've had Sylvanas basically cut him away from her, and I felt like, wow, this is interesting. What does it feel like to be the absolute diehard, ride or die, loyal forever person who then gets left? And with Sylvanas going through she's going through with the jailer, where the jailer has clearly done that to her, I felt like there's a lot of interesting stuff you could do with Nathanos, but they have not done it. And if it's just going to be more of Nathanos Blakehaller snarking at me, I've had my fill of it. If we're going to actually see Nathanos
react to what's happened to him?
No. I would love to see at the end of the raid, Nathanos comes in and literally dies for her in the Shadowlands, where that place where you could end up getting a true death if you do. And finally, it gets through to her that there's somebody who actually cares about her.
Like that's
the thing I don't think Sylvanas has ever really understood. Yes, she had the loyalty of the Forsaken, but there has always been one person who actually cares about her.
Yeah.
Not her position, not her power, not any of it. When she was alive and when she was dead, there has always been one person who cares about her. And I'm not saying that she has to, like, I'm not saying they have to, like, you know, run away together and go live in a cave somewhere, but I would love to see a moment of actual understanding of what she has missed, what she has lost because she couldn't focus on it. Like, imagine, you know, finally realizing, oh, I had this and I had it this whole time and I just used it. I didn't ever once take stock of it. I didn't recognize that it was real. There's so many character things that you could get out of these two, and they never really get them. And it's just, you know, here's more snarky Nathanos. That's one note. It's one dimensional. I'm tired of it.
Yeah, it gets old.
I have seen that Nathanos Blakehaller is a snarky jerk. What I have not seen is the guy who somewhere in him recognized that I just let my nephew die so I could have a body. There's always been moments where you get the sense there is more going on in Nathanos' head.
But you never get to see it.
Never get to see it. When he fought Tyrande and just, it was like, honestly, I thought her killing him the way she killed him, the casual dispatch of him, like, you're unimportant, was exactly right. Because he had done nothing to be important. So I want, if he shows up in this fight, I want him to be important. Not just as a fight mechanic, but his role should be important. Why is he there? Is he just there to be the same guy he's been ultimately, like, over and over again? Then I don't care. But if he's there to actually throw some light on the characterization of these two characters, if it is that moment where she realizes I did to him what the jailer is trying to do to me, then it could be interesting. So
yeah,
therefore, when we're talking about the reunions you're most looking forward to that he asked about,
yep,
I am completely uninterested in more Arthas. I don't want to see Arthas in this expansion. I don't care about Arthas. He got his story. He got everything he needed to get. It's more important what he did to other people than it is to see him, in my opinion.
I would agree.
But I think we probably will see him.
I think it's inevitable. The level of how important or what his story shows up as, I think will... I don't know what that will be, but I think we will see him, and I would not be surprised if he's in one of the torture chambers and if Sylvanas, that was part of her reward. Because him getting flung into the maw, he's in there somewhere. We just don't know what's going on with it yet. As far as reunions go, though, the one that I really, truly want the most is I want that Thrall and Garrosh encounter. I want that moment where Garrosh is already dead. Thrall can't do anything more to him. He can't avoid the fact that he killed him. And we know he's in Castle Nathria somewhere. And technically, we've just, at this point, canonically, we've thrown Sire Denathrius into a sword and have him captive, and he is being re-educated, I believe, is what they said it was happening to him. But if Garrosh is still under there and we go in and free him in the future, I want that encounter between him and Thrall. I want that reckoning in Thrall's eyes of, this is your fate was because of me. Everything from every horrible thing you did, I set you on that path to I took your life. You can see glimmers of that sort of starting to happen with Thrall already, as, like I mentioned earlier, where the elements come back to him when you're rescuing him from Torghast. And it's one of those things where I would love to see that come to a close, because I truly do feel that Garrosh, the ending that was given between Thrall and Garrosh was not satisfying. It was not satisfactory to me. In the moment, it made sense, but now we have an opportunity for something more, something different, something more complete. And I would be absolutely all about that. A close second, I wouldn't mind Jaina and Kael'thas being forced to interact with each other, because I think that would be incredibly interesting to see those two. And at this point,
do we need Jaina and her stalker? I mean, come on.
that's kind of why I want to see it. I want to see what her reaction is now that she is who she is. Now that she's gone through all of that stuff. Now that she's gone through the entire life. Whereas we talked about with him where, you know, he doesn't let go of his pride. It's sort of a source of power for him. She's become so much more over the years that I'd love to see her be able to, like, stare him down and make him wilt. Like, I'd love to have a moment for Jaina in that regard of, like, yeah, no, you're nothing to me. Peace.
She already did that, like, when she was, like, much younger and less mature, so it's not exactly going to be an accomplishment.
Well, she didn't really say you're nothing to me. She said you're not the one I choose. It's different.
But also, I think that to a certain degree, the Kael'thas that we have right now isn't the Kael'thas who was obsessed with her.
True.
That Kael'thas was, I feel like they could have a meeting where it would be very much, you know, she's like, you know, you were kind of creepy, and he'd be like, yes, I was dealing with things, but compared to what happened after, I'm sorry, you know, you're just not that important to me either. You know, I have not been spending all this time thinking about you. I was thinking about my people. I betrayed everybody I had any sort of connection to, hoping to save my people. If anything, quite frankly, I have more in common with Arthas than you right now. And that's true. Of the people around, the people who most understand where Kael'thas was going from in his last moments would be Arthas. That constant driving, obsessive desire to save your people without understanding that your people are not you. Both Kael'thas and Arthas had that same problem, where they identified their people with themselves so strongly that they were like, I'll do anything for my people. But half the time, what the anything they did was for them.
Yep, that incredibly selfish motivation behind the guise of selflessness.
They thought they were being selfless because they didn't understand that crucial fact. Your people are not you. You know, what's good for your people is not necessarily what you would want to do. And that's the problem. Everything Kael'thas does, if you look at the entirety of Burning Crusade, everything Kael'thas does to try and save his people is a betrayal of everything his people stand for.
Yeah.
And he does it over and over again. And yeah, the argument is the ends justify the means, but he did that so often that in the end, he didn't have the ends anymore. Because everything he was doing wasn't going to bring his people back. It was going to transform them so utterly they wouldn't be his people anymore. If you look at the Fel Elves, I don't know if they were called, but you saw them. They looked like demons. They were not, and they didn't act like Blood Elves. There's just that fascinating, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions concept that both Kael'thas and Arthas, in their own different ways, personify. And I would like to see This is one of the reasons why I really do hope the Legion isn't done. I don't want to see Sargeras come on back or anything, but I feel like just because a couple of really powerful demons got beat and that you know, Sargeras got locked away for a while. Sargeras was barely, you know, was kind of locked away for a while before.
It was really, himself- I mean, it was really what? Kill Jaden and, I can't think of his name now. Oh, bloody heck.
Kill Jaden and Archimonde?
Yeah. Sorry. It was, I mean, if anything, it was more them and then whoever they put in charge running the show than Sargeras.
Yeah, he was kind of the big picture guy. I think that there's just in general that idea. So I would like to see that, if anything, Kael'thas and Arthas.
Yeah, okay. I don't think there's anything else really to add to that. Yeah.
No, I'm good. Right. We can move on.
All right, our next one. Question for Lorewatch. I'm working on the Maldraxxus story, and Kael'thas has me running errands. During this, he has me get four books. One on the barriers and wards, one on the binding of the banished, one presumably Zoval, and one on Kyrian magic, and talks about a special Kyrian known as a bearer, specifically bearer Thedrin. Looking at this and watching the trailer for the next content patch, it looks like we can assume that Kael'thas is the one who is figuring out how to break the locks, ? Also, having not played through the Kyrian story, do we know what significance bearers have in Kyrian society, and how this could be related to the key portion taken from the Archon? Lastly, from the content patch video, the jailer says death was never meant to be chained. This looks to me, thinking about other theories on his crimes, like the jailer was banished for trying to free death and let it run rampant. Like maybe the first ones bound death in a way that allowed mortals to flourish, as well as the big floating chain thing that both death and the new zone. Y'all rock. Titan fuzz. I haven't done really anything in Maldraxxus, but I think that is interesting that it seems like Kael'thas is looking for specific literature on different things that might be related. Wards, Kyrian magic, binding the banished one, which also seems weird that they'd have a book on that, but who knows? One of the first ones, which is probably more like a, here's what we think the first ones were. But yeah, who knows? It seems like Kael'thas is definitely, I don't want to say working for the jailer, because Kael'thas generally is a little more self-serving than that, but it might be, he might be doing some bidding for him or working alongside of him because it suits his personal needs. And I don't know where his story is going to go, but I think at one point we're going to try to finally, like, fully, completely, totally off Kael'thas. As far as the Kyrian bearer, I don't know what that means, because I haven't done much of the Kyrian stuff.
Well, it doesn't matter. There is nothing in the game yet that says what he's a bearer of or what it means. It's just, we know it's part of Kael'thas' bizarre planning. I mean, you know, he's in the House of Rituals and he's definitely working with the forces of Revan. He's working with Denathrius ultimately. So he's definitely doing something. He's Margrave. He's now Margrave of the House of Rituals. So he's still working with the Maw. He's still working with Jailer. We don't really know exactly what his plans are, though. We don't know if he's researching all the ways to break the bonds, or if he's doing this for his own. Like, we don't know if he's doing this for the Jailer or for himself. I mean, he's working on a ritual to free the Jailer, but we don't know why he's doing it. Like, if he's really going to actually help the Jailer, or if he's got his eyes on the main prize, which is himself. He was always pretty loyal to the Lich King. Like, he didn't betray the Lich King when he had the chance to. So I don't know right now what the what Kael'thas is up to. But he definitely does seem to be, he's definitely up to something, and it might be involved in figuring out how to free the Jailer. I honestly think in the concept of the Jailer, the whole idea that death was never supposed to be chained, whenever the Jailer says that kind of stuff, I think he's talking about himself.
Yeah, like, I get that impression too.
I don't think he's talking about death as an impersonal cosmic force. I think he means himself. I think he thinks he is death. It's actually fairly similar to Diablo 3 with Malthiel calling himself Death and the Angel of Death. Malthiel wasn't the Angel of Death. You know, he was the Archangel of Wisdom. He decided, I'm the Angel of Death. He took that on himself. I feel like that's the Jailer is lives in the Shadowlands and is a powerful being, but I don't think he's death. And I think that that's kind of, once again, in a weird sort of way, this is a common theme in World of Warcraft where these people don't, they make the mistake of confusing themselves for things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like I said, both Arthas and Kael'thas confused their people with themselves. I think the Jailer is confused death with himself. And in fact, it might be that arrogance that made it so that they had to confine him. Because none of the ones we're seeing, none of the Pantheon of Death are death.
No, they're all just part of the cycle, right?
Yeah, and yet he's decided, I am death itself. So he stepped beyond his station. We don't know what his station originally was. We don't know what he did. Like, we can see, like, the Primus, the Archon, the, you know, the Night, the Winter Queen. We can see what they do. Like, they have roles. They provide functions. This implies that both the Arbiter and, you know, this is a really weird thought, but we keep talking about that hole in the Jailer's chest and how it looks similar to the thing the Arbiter has going. It's possible that that was Zoval's job.
Mm-hmm.
Zoval might have been, before the Arbiter, might have been the Arbiter.
He might have been Arbiter 1.0.
Or they might have been like one being, because we know that that's a thing that they love to do.
Oh, yeah. Blitz.
That idea of this one being that divides itself. Maybe there was one being that like decided it was going to be purely rational and pulled away, like it pulled all the rationality out of itself and created the Arbiter out of it. And then what was left was Zoval. I don't know. But I do know that I feel like Zoval often says things like, you know, death can't be, you know, death should never be chained. He's talking about himself. He means I shouldn't have been chained, but he would never say I. He's like Dr. Doom in a way where Doom just constantly calls himself Doom.
Yeah.
Doom, you know, Doom cannot be defeated. You're not actually Doom, Doom. Do you know that? You're not the concept of Doom. You're actually a person. I think that that's what's going on with Zoval when he says those things. But yeah, it is fascinating to think about what happened, because we're seeing, like I said, we're seeing that the Maw appears to have been smashed into pieces, and we're seeing them reclaim pieces and find things on them. And those things have connections to like to Ouroboros. And this makes me wonder if the entire Shadowlands was once one place. And if things continue as they are, could those chains come and grab Bastion? Could he actually shoot chains out of the Maw and drag all the other realms into the Maw? Is that what he's trying to do? Like, does he want to rebuild some primordial Shadowlands before the Falling type situation? Or is he just looking for a way to escape? I don't know, but I think there is something to this concept.
And I think this kind of bleeds into a little bit to the next question as well from Roxy, which is, Roxy, also known as Padilla. In the new Kingsmorne cinematic, the Jailer reveals that he's looking for three more keys. So there are many questions. Why three keys? Are they from the Eternals? If so, does he have Denathrius? Does he have the Rune Carvers? I mean, the Primuses. Is it five keys to open the path? Ilganoth? And if so, who has the fifth key? Lastly, in Afterlives, Maldraxxus, we get told multiple times that Draka is a key. Is that much more literal than we thought? Like, that is an interesting thing, and I've been thinking about this a little bit too. Like, we talk about the chains. Chains generally have keys. We talk about the warding. Warding generally tends to look like glyphs in this game, or something like that, and we do see that in that cinematic when Drone Anduin stabs the Kyrestria. She doesn't die, but the rune that's in her chest lights up that wasn't there before, was invisible at first, and gets sucked into the blade, and then he gives the blade to Zoval, and then Zoval does his little chainy thing. So what? But it was interesting when he says three more keys. Well, there's four realms of the Shadowlands that we know of. One would assume that if Denathrius was already working with him, that he'd let him have it, if that's what he wanted. And we can assume that the Primus had one, maybe. But he's got the Primus, or at least we're relatively confident he's got the Primus.
If he doesn't actually have the Primus, he beat the Primus. The Primus went after him and lost.
Yeah.
If he had the key on him, even if the Rune Carver is not the Primus, and I think that he is, but even if he's not, the Primus went into a fight with the Jailer and didn't come back from it. It would have been dumb for him, if he had a key,
to take it with him.
Yeah, don't bring it with you.
Yeah, which is what I was kind of thinking too. Is like, I'm wondering if Padilla's onto something. Maybe Draka was, when she showed up in Maldraxxus, was like branded with the key.
I mean, or he might have, you know, we don't know what these keys are. They're not like they're not like literally a keychain. You know, he doesn't actually, obviously Anduin stabs the Archon and takes something away from her, takes it out of her. The thing, therefore, it can be removed. It feels like it might be more conceptual than anything. So it's quite possible he just put it in her or infused her with it or something. I don't know. And we don't know how the, you know, if each, like, what would the Winter Queen's key be? I mean, would it be the actual heart of the forest itself that was used to lock him in? I mean, there's, I don't know. There's a lot to this we don't know yet.
Yeah, and I mean,
that's today. There's a lot we don't know yet. But we don't know. 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 No.
But it is.
No.
Thank you, Matt. but it is. It is actually very interesting to see like how this is all going to play into everything else, because Kyrestra may have been, that may have been a key. It may not have been a key. It could have been something else. Could have been a portion of her power. Whatever the case is, we don't know. Like Matt said, and saying, we don't generally know exactly what is meant by those quite yet. But it is very obvious that he is looking for something to let him out of his exile. And a book on how something was banished. Yeah, probably a good indicator that he's got people looking for it and trying to figure out how to get him out of there from the outside, because like any good prison, you're
maintaining again that the entire reason he wanted Helya to be working for him is because she's really good at building prison planes.
Yep.
And you want somebody to get you out of a prison plane, you get somebody who's really good at making them.
Especially if we assume that she studied the Maw to learn how to make it in the first place. Because we don't know what she studied when she looked into the Shadowlands.
We know she was looking into the Shadowlands. We know she's the one that connected up Odin with Muzala in the first place. And we know that the eye of the jailer is almost certainly Odin's eye.
Yeah.
And has been basically given some kind of independent existence as a servant to the jailer. And that implies a lot about the relative relationship, of these beings, and why you'd want Helya was the one that connected them. Helya was the one that reached into the Shadowlands and pulled things forth. She's the one that could summon them. So yeah, there is a lot going on to that as well. I definitely think that we're looking at the final end. We're coming in literally from the jailer's perspective. We are extremely annoying because this is the end of a plan that's been going on since like
eons.
Who knows how long, but we're finally like, we are at the point where you are just about ready to step through the door and reveal that you've succeeded at your master plan, and now these people show up who mess up every plan. It's like, you had like, I'm almost out. These people suck. I don't want to deal with you. Which might be why he never actually stands there and deals with us. Like, you know, we're not important. We're just these annoying things that showed up at the last minute. Deal with them. I have things to do here.
And you definitely get that impression whenever you see him, even when he's interacting with Sylvanas in any of the cutscenes or anything that involves him, is like, we are a nuisance. We are not important. He's got vast like amounts of minions to deal with us, and that's their job. Like, he has entire armies of twisted, weird soul things that he shoved together and set off on patrol. Like, he expects them to deal with us. Like, he's got the Terra Gru, which should deal with us. He doesn't have to deal with us. We are not on his level. We are not important beyond what we can give him, which we already did by, you know, the whole Anduin thing. So like, him not having time for us, him not caring about us, makes perfect sense. And honestly, I kind of like this as a villain thing goes. And story-wise, it feels the most like a powerful bad guy that we've ever encountered. It just to kind of throw it out there, in the past, we've had the Lich King, who was way too involved in our lives when it came to the Wrath of the Lich King. He was everywhere, paying attention to us, always, you know, looking onto us because we were a threat to him. Illidan, we saw twice.
Oh, no, you are totally wrong.
Go ahead.
You have completely misconstrued Arthas's relationship. We weren't a threat to him. We were a threat to Azeroth.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough.
We served as an ego boost because young heroes, I was most once like you. So anything we did that, you know, made him feel like he made the right choice, yay. But also, he wanted us to prove we were strong enough to be worth killing and turning into like undead servants to conquer the world for him. He was looking for another Arthas. This time he wanted a bunch of Arthases.
Fair enough.
That he's going for. So no, I think people constantly fixate on the Lich King and say, oh, he's too involved and all that. I think that comes from a misreading of what was going on. And I think that misreading comes from the fact that you only get that thing I just said in the raid at the end of the fight. You only get that if you do the fight. And, you know, so a lot of players never got that didn't get it till they've done it. And by then they'd had the whole expansion and be like, oh God, here he is again. You know, so I feel like that's just a failure of the storytelling structure. And I think that to a certain degree, what we're getting the jailer is a success of the storytelling structure.
Yes.
In that it's giving you the aloofness. It's kind of like Illidan, who barely interacted with us, but it didn't feel like Illidan, who was like kind of, we kept being told Illidan was like out of control. He was nuts. He was,
but we never saw it.
We never saw much of anything. So we didn't know what was going on with that. The Illidan novel really does a good job of saying, okay, this is why he was doing that stuff.
But until we had that novel, we didn't, which is the point I'm trying to make is that I think this is the best representation of, at least in my opinion, of a powerful being that is interacting with us. Cause even old gods, like they're supposed to be these all powerful things. They're super involved and they're super present. Nazoth, you know, the whole whispering and the invasion points and all that other stuff. I'm not saying it was bad, but it didn't feel like he was out of reach of us. Even Azjara, to a point, felt like she was out of reach until we started going into her palace and things started getting a little heated. Like, Zolval doesn't, we're not on his radar. We're annoyances. He knows we exist, but he's not concerned. And that comes across very clearly. That reads very clearly. Now, that may change in the future as we start messing up his plans, but I like that a lot. I like the idea that we know what we're struggling against and he doesn't care about us. Or at least, you know, not enough to actually face us himself yet. And I feel that it's, like you said, it's a success of the storytelling. I really, really like that. And I think it's going to produce some very interesting interactions going forward, especially as we get into the new zone, especially as 9.1 hits and we start moving forward with the story, and especially after we deal with Sylvanas and at least the first time in Shadowlands. It's going to produce a lot of very, very interesting things. So I think that's going to do us for time. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And again, if you do have questions for the podcast, be sure to send them into podcast@BlizzardWatch.com or one of our multiple Discord channels, and we'll be more than happy to answer them as we have time. Make sure that you do put what show it's for and pronunciation of your name. But with that, folks, we'll see you next week.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.